Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the first FIA Group webinar of 2017. We're very excited to have you. We have hundreds of you on the phone right now, so thank you so much for dialing in and seeing our webinar. As you can tell, for 2017, we have a brand new look. I think people will think this is a nice look. Please send us a comment if you think it's pretty cool. We try to simplify things, and if you'll notice the little icons on the bottom, the Learn, Plan, Save, Protect, that's the four things that we try to do at FIA Group for all of our clients. And this session is going to be called Back to the Self-Funding Future, which echoes of 2016 will continue to impact self-funding in 2017. I'd love to take credit for that great topic, but I can't. Ron Peck wrote that. After about 15 drafts, I finally said it's good enough for our audience. But really, that's what it is we want to talk about what's going to happen in 2017, and we're very excited. In addition, want to let you all know we will be starting podcasts, 5 to 10 minute long podcasts. It could be either every week or every couple weeks, something you can quickly listen to, 5 minutes. We're going to obviously want topics from you in regards to what those podcasts should be about. We have the first couple of them down already, but we bought all the equipment. We have a studio at the FIA Group offices. We're very excited about the studio we're building, and we're hoping that this podcast will grow and be so big that we end up having guests. Maybe one of you out there will be our guest, and we'll have, you know, questions and talk about industry topics, so we're very excited about that. But again, as always, thank you for joining us this year. We're excited. And today's speakers, just so you guys know, is myself, and with me, as always, is Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
And as always, our crowd favorite, for whatever reason, people love her, Jen McCormick.
Hello.
And last but not least is Brady Bizarro, one of our staff attorneys who's taken a big jump here. He is our political junkie. He is our political guru. He'll be joining us here today as well. Say hello, Brady.
Hello, hello.
Brady will be leaving FIA today. The Amtrak train, the Acela Express at least. You afford, do I pay you enough money to afford that?
I think so, yeah. That's the professional one.
That's the right. That's the one. That's the one. He's taking the train. Yes, there are people that still take the train, guys, instead of flying. He's going to be going to D.C. for the inauguration, so we're very excited for Brady. Hopefully, he's a big presence on social media. Hopefully, Brady, who just had his article published in the Self-Assure magazine and shared it with all of his family, they were very excited to throw a party for him. I think it was pretty nice. But hopefully when Bob Brady's at the inauguration, he can take a couple selfies and post it online as well and share with all of our friends on social media. So be on the lookout for that tomorrow at some point from the FIA Group LinkedIn page. All right. With that, as always, folks, please email us, text us your questions there. And if we think the question is pertinent to our discussion, we're going to bring it up. If we see any from our Sicko fans, we have a couple of you out there. You know who you are. We will ignore those because they just constantly just send comments and questions over and over again to try to, I don't know what they're trying to do. Maybe they're trying to find a way to have those whole thing get blown up and shut down. I don't know.
You can invite them for one of our podcasts, Adam.
Right. We'll invite them for the podcast.
They're looking for a forum to be heard.
Right. So, as always, folks, as you know, PGC referral at fiagroup.com is where thousands of you go every single month for all of your consulting needs. That is where we come up with our frequently asked questions. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the lovely Jen McCormick to talk about December 2016's most frequently asked questions. Jen?
Awesome. All right. Now the good part, the part everyone has been waiting for. What was Noach talked about last month? I know that there are only a couple of things on this slide, but there are a lot of really interesting and exciting things that had happened in 2016. And as we were closing up the year, a lot of these questions came to light, and I'm going to give you the inside edition of what it is that you need to know as it relates to these FAQs. Number one, what are the TPA's obligations with respect to Section 1557 of ACA? So I'm first going to caveat this and say that I'm talking about the TPA's obligations for 1557, assuming the TPA itself is not a covered entity. So if you are a TPA that is not a covered entity, but you do have groups that are considered covered entities, what is your obligation? What are you responsible for? So the first answer is nothing, unless you have otherwise agreed to do certain things or be responsible for certain things through your administrative services agreement. So keeping in mind when you are looking at a group and you are trying to decide whether or not this is a covered entity, the ultimately, this is a responsibility of the employer to decide to determine whether or not they themselves are a covered entity. It's not the TPA's obligation to decide whether or not that group is a covered entity. It's only if you have a group that is a covered entity that certain obligations and requirements are going to come into play. So now, as these groups are renewing, as you are going through the steps to do enrollment and handle renewals, it's going to be important for you to somehow document your file, make sure that there is evidence somewhere of how or whether or not a group is a covered entity. So you'll have that on file. You can document what it is that you need to do, if anything, and if anything means that you potentially need to revise your administrative services agreement to ensure that you can reflect what it is that this group as a covered entity wants you to do. As you know, I'm sure that we've talked about it in the past before. You've heard about it. You've been reading articles. There have been there's a lot of action, a lot of talk about 1557, an injunction, but there are still documentation requirements, tagline requirements, and those are things that a covered entity has to comply with. And as an administrator for these groups, there are certain things that you might need to do or want to do to show that you are involved, that you know what is going on, that you are able to help these groups with their compliance obligations under 1557. So our recommendation when the TPA asks, what is their responsibility when it comes to this regulation, is to first confirm, document, and have evidence somewhere that the group is or is not a covered entity. And if the group is a covered entity, then it's going to be important for you to review your ASA, your administrative services agreement, to see what obligations you have already agreed to and whether or not it's worth revising your administrative services agreement in order to outline what it is that the group might want you to do on their behalf, whether it's documentation, EOBs, appeals letters, whatever the case may be. All of those things should be thought of and addressed as you're going through renewal. Second, another important question that has been coming up, and it's particularly important as we're going through the renewal period, is we're talking about the benchmark plan. Talk about what's the difference between a benchmark and what's the difference between a mandated benefit, and why does this matter for a self-funded plan? Well, the answer is there are such things called essential health benefits. In order to decide what is an essential health benefit, you need to refer to a benchmark plan. So on the CMS website, they have identified various benchmark plans and things that you can use when you're deciding what it is that you want to decide to be essential or not essential. It's going to be imperative that a group somewhere, somehow, determines what is going to be the benchmark that they will use for deciding whether a benefit is essential or not. The reason this is important is because you are not allowed to have an essential health benefit have a dollar limitation on it. So in order to not have any dollar limitations on essential health benefits, you need to have a benchmark for what is an essential health benefit in the first place. So it's going to be important that you have that documented, that you talk to the groups during renewal about that. And how does that vary for a state-mandated benefit? Well, particularly the groups that are non-ERISA groups, they may be subject to the state-mandated benefits. And this gets a little bit confusing when you're trying to look at the benchmark plan, but then also match and include any of the state-mandated benefits. What if there's a state-mandated benefit that has a dollar limit, and on the state benchmark plan, that's considered essential? What should you do? Well, if you are going to act in good faith and try to comply with what the regulations are, the answer would be to remove the dollar limitation on something that is to be considered essential. Remember that even if you are a non-ERISA plan, you don't have to pick the state benchmark where the plan is domiciled. You can pick a benchmark that most accurately reflects the benefits in the group's view of what benefits are going to be essential. It's just important that you pick one. It could be California if you're in Massachusetts. It could be Utah if you're in Florida. It doesn't matter as long as that's reflected and documented. Another little bonus question here, too, is whether or not you're allowed to have an additional waiting period for a specific benefit. And the answer is no. You shouldn't be imposing an additional waiting period on a benefit. And this has come up a lot recently with people who want to offer benefits to everyone after their 90-day waiting period, but then for other benefits, the more expensive benefits, imposing an additional waiting period. And our review of the regulations has found that that would not be something that would be appropriate. So there should be one waiting period that should not exceed the 90 days. And last but not least, we are seeing a lot of questions now about how employers can reduce costs or maintain costs since they're getting really high when it comes to mental health benefits or substance abuse benefits. This might have to do with a lot of the commercials and things that we are seeing, at least over here in Massachusetts, about facilities that those who might be running into addiction issues are able to go to this facility and then the background and see people sitting by the pool or nice and calm. And so we have seen an increase in those individuals who have been utilizing those services, which is great, but it has been difficult for the plan to figure out what their obligations are and if there's anything that they can do to help maintain some of these costs, because it is very expensive, particularly when they're seeing $3,000 per day in lab services occur. So remember, when it comes to mental health services, a plan is not required to cover mental health or substance abuse. So it is possible that the plan could make the decision that these costs are too high for them, and they could completely exclude the entire category of mental health or substance use benefits from their plan. Obviously, there's going to be consequences if you decide to remove an entire category of benefits. Another option potentially could be if you have a plan that is a PPO structure plan, you could eliminate the out-of-network access and have an EPO structure. That would have other implications, obviously, but then it would be limited to covered benefits that you would see through a network provider, eliminating the out-of-network lab costs. And another really equally exciting option would be to have some parameters, UNC parameters, max level amount that has a variety of parameters where you could reprice and negotiate what lab service costs you are paying based on parameters that are outlined in the plan. So now is a really important time to take a look at your plan documents to make sure that you do have those parameters listed so you can actually utilize those to help keep the cost down, not only for mental health services, but for any services that the plan might encounter. That's really exciting. That's all of the FAQs I have for today. But obviously, if you guys have other questions, you know exactly where to go, PGC referral.
So it's pretty obvious, Jen. Great job, as always. She's very excited. It talked about 10 minutes about one slide, so we're already behind schedule. So thanks, Jen. As always, folks, every month we have a LinkedIn and Twitter contest winner. All you got to do is say something nice about Jen on Twitter or LinkedIn, and you'll get 1 free-hour consultative guidance. So please visit our LinkedIn page. Go tap on Ask the Fia Group. Say something nice about Jen and what she just happened to say. If any of you guys understood actually what she said. If not, that's when you have to reach out and talk to her, and you get that 1 free-hour. So thank you so much. So really quick, want to let everyone know, if you weren't on the reporting portal webinar that we did, I believe it was on January 3rd, earlier this month, please reach out to Marta Butkiewicz. Yes, she is Polish. And yes, I do speak Polish, so I can pronounce her last name. The W is a V sound. Reach out to her. Her email and phone number is there to schedule a personalized training session for you and your team. If you want to see the latest updates in 2017 or as to what we can do, we now have on-demand status reports. Live. See whatever you want to see. Really great historical overview reports that have been updated and made much nicer by our IT team. So feel free to do that. Also, we hosted a webinar. You can actually download it and see it right there if you don't want to personally talk to Marta. Also, big news. See that good-looking guy there? Yep. Ron, you're not the best-looking guy at FIA anymore. We're sorry. But we have attorney Tim Callender has been named our Vice President of Sales and Marketing. Tim has been in the TPA industry for many, many years. He was general counsel for a TPA in Boise, and that's where he has an office, a FIA. We call it FIA West. We have an office out there in Boise, Idaho, right there in the mountains, and we're excited for having Tim not only now run our PACE product and work on our legal team, but now he is running and being a visionary behind our entire sales and marketing push. So we're excited to have him aboard, and I know the rest of the industry is as well. Okay, I want to focus really quickly on what we're going to talk about. First, the Trump transition update. A lot's going to change over the next few months. So even if the topic for the webinar isn't Trump, we're going to bring it up because a lot of you are asking. Brady's going to have an interview with President-elect Trump tomorrow so you can personally find out how he's going to affect the self-funded industry as a whole, which is great. We're going to have to charge. If we have a webinar on that, we'd have to charge for that one. We've got to make some money. Yeah. Top cost drivers in 2016, the legal and regulatory burdens, which I'm assuming Jen will jump on again. We're going to talk about stop loss, keeping self-funding viable. What are the threats there and some of the new things we noticed? Last but not least, the increased fiduciary burden. So with that, Brady, who's wearing his red, white, and blue tie with the beautiful American eagle, flying through the mountains. He has a very ugly tie on, folks. You got to see this thing. But with that, we're going to turn it over to Brady, talk about the Trump transition update. Brady?
Well, thanks, Adam. As many of you know, this is an ongoing process for us and for everyone else out there. The Trump transition is rolling on full steam ahead. And this week and last week, there's been a number of confirmation hearings going on. And for our purposes, it's most important to focus on his pick for the Department of Health and Human Services. And that hearing happened yesterday. It was 8 hours long. And thankfully, I watched most of it so that you guys don't have to. But he's also before a second committee next week. And that's the committee that he will have to impress the most because they're actually voting on his confirmation. But as I said, he's leading a department that spends $1.1 trillion a year. So it's a big deal. He's tasked with coming up with the concrete alternatives to the ACA and to give Americans more choice of lower-cost insurance. So this is why he's facing a lot of tough questions, especially from Democrats. So what were some of the highlights of his hearing from yesterday? Well, mostly Democrats are concerned that the Trump administration is ready to move ahead with repeal, and they're not ready to move ahead with replace. So on top of that, there are some ethical issues with his pick, and so they're calling for him to be investigated and his nomination to be slowed down. One of the problems is that Representative Price has investments in a few stocks in companies which he later introduced bills which affected their bottom line. And one example was a company that works with hip and knee replacements for Medicare patients. For those types of services, Medicare limits reimbursement, and Representative Price introduced a bill a few days after he had stock in that company bought, which would have raised the amount that that company could charge for those particular procedures. So Democrats are looking into that. That's sort of slowing down the process here. But some key highlights I wrote down here. Representative Price has said that repealing and replacing the ACA would not leave millions of people without health insurance, which is one of the fears Democrats have. He did offer lofty goals for replacing the law, but he did not give very many details on the Trump administration's plans. He did not rule out cuts to Medicare or Medicaid, and he was pressed to say that health care for all is a right, which he would not say. Instead, he focused on talking about quality access to care and noting that the importance of bringing down the cost of care. If he's confirmed, we expect it to happen in early February, so keep an eye on that. As I mentioned, next week he meets with the Senate Finance Committee, and he's got to impress them the most. We also are seeing here a number of regulations starting to be rolled back by the judiciary. This is happening, you know, in parallel to all the fight over repeal and replace. Essentially what's going on here is you have a number of judges in the federal circuit who are looking at administration actions and finding that some of them may have went too far. And so Jen will have more to say on this later, but we're talking about the injunction that occurred with regard to Section 1557. So it was a court in the Northern District of Texas, which basically is now saying that HHS cannot enforce the anti-discrimination provisions of Section 1557. And as I said, Jen will go into more of this in detail, but there's a theme emerging here, which is that the federal judiciary is going to be relying on certain statutes to probably find that the administration previous had gone too far in certain regulations, and those we expect to be the Administrative Procedure Act and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Those are two acts which Republicans have been pushing for to become more important again, which would roll back some of these federal-based regulations. Another case to watch, which is coming up in the Supreme Court on the new session, is Gloucester versus Grimm. We expect that case to perhaps provide us with better definitions of important terms that we've been encountering, like gender identity. That's come up in the public bathroom debate, and so we're keeping our eye on that to see what happens next.
Did you say Gloucester?
That's how I pronounce it, Adam. Yes, it was.
Just to make sure, you are from this area, right? It's Gloucester.
Gloucester. I apologize.
I'm just saying, folks, for those of you who aren't from Massachusetts,
it's Worcester. Yep.
The fact that he just said that freaked me out. Like, I think you were raised here, right?
I was born and raised. Yeah.
Okay, you have to get out of the house more often. Okay.
So getting back to this case, as I said, we expect it to perhaps give us some important definitions, and we'll be watching that in a number of other states, such as the Hobby Lobby follow-up cases, which we expect will perhaps lead to the rollback of some additional regulations. So we'll see where that goes. Now, where are we with the update on repeal and replace? Well, that depends on who you ask. In an interview with 60 Minutes, the president-elect said that repeal and replace would happen simultaneously. Speaker Paul Ryan has said that it would be done concurrently. And then last week, the Senate Majority Leader has said that we need to do this, quote, promptly, but in, quote, manageable pieces. And so that's all very confusing and frustrating for us and for patients and providers. But what we do know is that Congress is moving quickly on the repeal part of repeal and replace. 1 a.m. Thursday of last week, the Senate voted to approve a budget that the Republicans have to use to repeal the ACA. And that's important because there was at least one prominent Republican senator who wanted to slow this process down to give lawmakers more time to come up with the alternative. And obviously, he wasn't listened to. The House already had approved a procedural rule which would allow Congress to pass a replacement bill more quickly without Democrats being able to filibuster it. And the House on last Friday approved the budget that the Senate had already approved. What happens next? Well, the House has to draft a replacement bill and vote on it. And that's when they'll be working with the proposed Representative Tom Price, if he's confirmed, and with the Trump administration to come up with that bill. And then it goes to the Senate, a series of debates and amendments will occur, and committee conferences, and then President-elect Trump can sign the bill into law. So in short, there's a while to go still on this front for repeal and replace. Importantly, though, some Republican senators are nervous about not having a replacement ready. I named a few here, Rand Paul, John McCain, Lamar Alexander. There's also a few others, Susan Collins from Maine. And some of the governors of states are concerned that they may have expanded Medicaid in their state, and they're expecting, you know, federal reimbursement for a lot of the cost of this program. And if that's gutted without a replacement, they may find many of their insureds no longer have access to coverage. And so there's a lot of pressure to really come up with an in-depth replacement bill. But as I mentioned, it's just not quite there yet. So this graph here shows that a majority of Trump voters and how they feel about particular parts of the ACA. Now, you may expect here that the least two popular provisions of the ACA are the mandates, right? So keeping an employer mandate with a penalty, that's only 49%. The individual mandate, that's 16%. But look at the top of this chart, and you'll see a familiar theme here, which is that people like the provisions which allow young adults to stay on their parents' plan and plans until age 26. They like the fact that you have no out-of-pocket costs for certain preventive services. They like the actual exchanges if they work for individuals and for small businesses. They want to close the Medicare prescription drug donut hole. They do like subsidies when they're provided to low-income Americans. And so the trend here is that essentially people like the most costly parts of the ACA. And so the trick will be for the administration coming up with a plan that, you know, how do you keep the provisions which are expensive that people like, the guaranteed issue, the extension of coverage, and how do you fund that if you're not going to have some sort of mandate that's paired with it, which has a pretty hefty penalty? And so there's no surprise that it's tough in figuring out how to go forward with that.
One of the big things I noticed is, that Trump brought up was the prescription drug, negotiating the pricing, how we currently don't do that with Medicare and Medicaid, which is true. I know that a couple of years ago I even discussed it during our webinar and our many speeches across the country, how literally Congress passed a bill that doesn't allow us to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies on the price of drugs, even though every other free country in the world can. So that's, an obvious area where you could save some money. But I just thought I'd bring that up because I see that the prescription drug coverage gap is a very popular piece that people want to close, that gap.
Right.
So that's an easy way to do it, is to make the price lower.
And that may actually be one of the most interesting things to follow in whatever becomes of the ACA, because it's rare, obviously, for a Republican to be supporting, you know, taking on the pharmaceutical industry and trying to control the cost of drugs. But as you mentioned, Adam mentioned there, the ability to negotiate drug prices from Medicare's part, which is by far the largest purchaser of drugs, would help bring down the price. And most, if not every other industrialized country in the world, allows their government to negotiate prices of drugs with manufacturers to drop down the price. So we'll keep an eye on how that proceeds. But it's unpopular in Congress, you know, may or may not, because some of them are funded perhaps by that exact same lobby, but we'll see where that goes. So one of the reasons why we want to focus here on the Empowering Patients First Act is because this is an act that was the idea of Representative Tom Price.
If he gets in.
But it could form the basis for a replacement. It's the most detailed proposal that's out there. I mean, the biggest problems of the ACA are clear enough to both Democrats and Republicans. As we know, the exchanges are near collapse in many states. Premiums and copays are up. Employers have had to cut jobs to be able to afford to comply with a lot of the federal regulations. The Medicaid mandates are consuming state budgets, including here in Massachusetts. In one-third of counties, we mentioned this last time, I think, how citizens with federal subsidies have only a single choice of company from which they can buy insurance on the exchanges. And 43% of enrollees have a deductible above $2,500. So there's a lot of big problems, and the Republicans in Congress have likened the problems here to a collapsing bridge. You rescue those trapped in the collapsing system, and in their mind, that's the 11 million people who buy individual insurance on the exchanges, and then you replace that system with functioning markets as states develop their own plans for affordable care. And then finally, you repeal the ACA. That's what I think most of Congress would like to see happen. They don't want to see this hasty business where you just repeal without a plan, and you leave, you know, people in our industry and providers and patients with a lot of problems. The theme is, from Republicans' point of view, to move healthcare decisions away from the federal government and into the hands of the states and patients themselves. And so PRICES Act, as I mentioned, is one of the most detailed acts out there. It would repeal the Medicaid expansion from the states, although they could still expand if they wanted to. It would repeal the subsidies, the insurance regulations, so you wouldn't even really have essential health benefits under this particular plan. And it would also remove the consumer out-of-pocket protections. But instead of these regulations from the ACA, it would create an age-based tax credit for people buying insurance on their own. And you wouldn't, of course, be eligible if your employer or the government pays for your health care. That tax credit could range anywhere from $900 for children under 18 to $3,000 for those 51 and older. But as tax credits are the same for everyone. And if you look at here the next slide, you'll see that this is a slide of an example of a 52-year-old male enrollee under PRICES plan versus the ACA, and you take a look at what kind of subsidies they will get, you'll see that the lighter blue column there is even across the board. So someone making $20,000 a year is going to get the same amount of subsidies to help them buy insurance as someone who's making $60,000 a year, whereas the ACA, it's skewed much more heavily toward those on the lower income side. So that's the Republican idea, is sort of balance things out and allow the states much more flexibility with, you know, they want to block grant Medicaid back to the states, and they really like to see a lot of the subsidies actually go down overall completely. But that's the plan that I think is most likely to be drawn from going forward because, as I said, it's so detailed. But we'll wait and see what Trump ends up doing, and that starts with seeing if his pick for HHS gets confirmed next week.
So a couple of things, folks. One, obviously we're going to follow up next month on the webinar, but don't be surprised if we have a couple podcasts that pop up. So make sure we will have emails that go out to all of you, just like we do for our webinars, advising you to feel free to listen to our podcasts on our website. And we'll also put that information on social media because I think it's clear that many of you are going to want an update in regards to that. And before we turn it over to Ron, I want to make sure everyone knows that on February 21st in Austin, Texas, Brady will be doing his first ever presentation in front of a live audience at the TABA conference where he's going to talk about many of the same issues that we're talking about today. So I hope you share just with me our best wishes for him to really do a great job next month over there at TABA, because God knows Ron and I can't be the only ones across the country that are speaking at these things. We need other people. So good job, Brady. All right, Ron, I'm turning it over to you.
Sure, thanks. Brady, I tell you to break a leg, but you're on our health plan, so I try and keep it safe. So speaking of costs of plans, I get to talk a little bit about the things that are giving you nightmares. You know, it's funny, before I get started, I look at a statistic, 1% of patients account for 22.7% of spending. I don't know what statistician came up with these numbers. I love the 0.7. Had they said 23%, you'd say it's made up. But 0.7, it must be accurate, right? Because that's the kind of thing only a computer spits out. But it's like they say, 75% of statistics are made up. But regardless of the actual number itself, we all know that there are a few people with high-dollar claims, and then the rest are sort of this underlying foundation. And when we talk about the cost drivers, even if you look at 22.7% of spending, that's still leaving, you know, almost 80% of your costs are spread throughout the rest. So while it's easy to point the finger at this 1 or 2%, you know, the bottom line is the costs are coming from multiple different sources. Yeah, this 1%, they're chopping your head off, but the 80%, you know, or rather 99% of your membership, they're death by a million paper cuts, right? So when it comes to addressing costs, you know, there's two types of costs that you need to address. There's those costs that come in, that claim that comes in, and it punches you in the chin, right? We look at things like organ transplants. I mean, I was looking online, an intestine transplant. My Lord, well over a million, almost $2 million. You know, a heart transplant, right? Not that outlandish, $800,000. So that's the type of claim that comes through the door, and again, it punches you in the chin. But that's also important because it's not just going to involve
the benefit plan. It's also going to involve the stop-loss carrier, if you're part of the captive. So you're involving multiple parties. Whereas when I talk about death by a thousand paper cuts, this is where you start to see different vendors out there, different programs that claim that they're going to reduce your spend on chronic diseases, sort of those claims that are not large in and of themselves, but as they start to pile up in the aggregate, you see cost drivers there. So when we're addressing costs, we need to look at, A, those individual high-dollar claims, but then, B, that underlying foundation of lower claims that tend to pile up. And sort of either way, when you're talking about a high-dollar claim or multiple low-dollar claims, one word keeps coming to mind. Drugs, right? Medication. You've heard it multiple times. It's absolutely true. When you look at this slide, these were the top cost drivers in 2016. Am I saying that these are the same cost drivers for 2017? No way. I'm sure there's going to be new drugs with weird names that I can't pronounce. But it's the nature of the claim itself. RX spending, specialty drugs, complicated surgeries, transplants, and I love that sepsis is up there. Look at that. It is one of the top cost drivers. If you've dealt with us on a subrogation claim or recovery claim, you see this and you're thinking, that's not even a health condition that somebody had going into the facility. It's literally something that was caused by the facility. It's almost as if a patient goes in for a colonoscopy. Hospital's like, oh man, we're only going to get a few grand off this guy. What do you say? We poison his blood and take a couple hundred grand. I'm going to get off my
soapbox. Relax, Ron.
I think that these are going to continue.
Some of that legal marijuana we have.
When we talk about those never events, and of course the problem is that any kind of reform that impacts medical malpractice, you know, when they're trying to prevent frivolous lawsuits, at the same time, they're putting roadblocks up when it comes to trying to recoup these claims or avoid payment of these what I would consider unreasonable never event claims. So it's a very fine line to walk. I believe that each of these types of costs can be addressed in different ways through different strategies. Too much to talk about right now, but I would certainly suggest that if you feel the pain from any of these types of claims, give us a call and see if there's something out there that can help you.
Before you get into the legal and regulatory burdens, I know we have a couple questions that came in regarding grandfathering and the Cadillac tax. If you wouldn't mind just sharing some insight on those before we get into the slide.
Sure. There was a question that was going back to the mental health substance abuse issues and asking whether or not that applies to grandfather plans or to all plans. And just to clarify, the mental health substance abuse benefit, just because something is listed as an essential health benefit doesn't mean the plan must cover it. All it means is that if the plan does cover it, it has to be covered without any sort of dollar limitations. And the essential health benefit determination, picking a state benchmark plan or the picking a benchmark plan, that applies to all plans, regardless of whether or not they are grandfathered or not. There was one other question, too, that I wanted to clarify about mental health, too, and that was about switching from an EPO or PPO to an EPO structure. I just wanted to clarify, too, that if you, as far as that suggestion was concerned, that would be specific to the entirety of the benefit. So if you're going to make any wholesale changes to the structure of your plan, it needs to be made to not only the mental health benefits, but to the medical and surgical benefits as well, because the rest of the name of the act, mental health parity, is parity. So everything that you need to do for mental health or substance use needs to be offered in parity as well. Okay. So getting on to these FAQs here, there were some recent FAQs that were released just in December towards the end of the year. It is like a Christmas present. Actually, it was in the middle of Christmas and Hanukkah, so it's like a both present.
All right.
There are a couple of good things I wanted to highlight from these FAQs that came out. One related to the special enrollment rights. So while there was an FAQ about this, I do think that it is important to note, and important to note that if you use FIA for your plan drafting needs, then there are going to be no changes to your document that are required because our language already addresses this. This part of the FAQ is actually kind of clarifying that regardless of how you would lose coverage, you would still could have the potential for a open enrollment right on the plan. So specifically, if you were enrolled in a individual plan maybe offered through the exchange, that loss of that coverage would be considered and make you eligible for, if you were otherwise eligible, for a special enrollment opportunity under your employer-based plan. So why do you think that they issued this FAQ? Well, potentially people were pretty concerned about what would happen if the administration was changing and there was going to be some repealing, replacing, dismantling, whatever you want to call it, for ACA and how that would impact the coverage they currently have on the marketplace. So the regulators did decide to clarify that any loss of coverage, individual or otherwise, would still be a special enrollment opportunity, so you could enroll for coverage under your own plan. So if you don't know whether or not your language in your documents right now is clear on that, it might be important for you to go revisit that just to make sure that it doesn't say that or anything that would contradict what this FAQ is requiring you to say or provide or offer. Next, there was an FAQ about the preventive services, specifically the women's preventive services. Now, there are a lot of different agencies and groups and associations who are identifying time frames for when women's services should be provided. And with those time frames, I mean ages. So sometimes the requirements to get some of these or have these benefits available to you start at age 40, sometimes 45, and sometimes age 50. And going and reading the legislative history of all when these women's services are going to be required to be provided, it's very confusing. And based on these most recent FAQs, we're actually reverting to time frames that were in place prior to the ones that as they exist now. So there's a lot of complication and confusion about what age limitations you must outline and provide coverage for, whether it's 40 or whether it's 50. So it's important to carefully read those and make sure that your plans are not necessarily referencing out-of-date information, and that when your systems and you're processing these claims for preventive services, that you're doing so in line with what the regulations require. And one of the things that hasn't gotten much airtime yet is the Cures Act. So this is a new regulation, a new FAQ about a new opportunity for small employers. So just to clarify, this is going to be a new type of HRA. This is not impacting whatsoever the traditional HRAs as we know them and as they exist today. This is a new opportunity for a HSA or HRA for a small employer. So there are a lot of qualifications that must align in order for a small employer to offer an HRA, but it's a $5,000 cap, $4,950 per individual that an employer is allowed to put together if they don't otherwise offer coverage. So if you have small employers that are looking at potential options, they should examine these small employer HRAs and see if this would be potentially a good fit for them. And next, Brady talked about this a little bit earlier, too, talking about the Section 1557 and the injunction that had been issued. So this was a New Year's Eve treat on the 31st of December. This injunction was released. So the thing to note about this is for certain things, there has been an injunction. So as it relates to the abortion services specifically and the treatment of gender identity, everything else still stands in place. So 1557 isn't specific to transgender or gender identity and abortion services. There are other things under that act that still are in place, and those are the prohibition of discrimination on disability, race, color, age, and national origin, so in sex other than gender identity. So it's important to realize that although part of this there is an injunction in place for, it doesn't apply to everything. So a conservative view at this point, until everything kind of falls into place and we know exactly what's going to be required, is to, especially if you've already made changes to documents and to plans, is to continue on with those. But there should be discussions about whether or not this is going, what the employer, what they decide under their discretion would be important for them to do. So we do expect for this to be a hot topic for people to continue to be talking about and to be further fleshed out. But do remember that the injunction only applies to part of 1557, not the entirety of 1557.
Here's what we do know. In regards to our ICE service, that, you know, where the TPAs or brokers have access to our entire legal team, the gender reassignment issue has come up from every one of our clients. I mean, so obviously, you're right, it is a hot topic that people are asking about, and I think it's because our TPA clients, their clients are asking them about it as right. well. So good information, Jen.
So they drive the conversation. You know, just real quick also, I just want to point out something. No one else has brought this up. In the comments, Brady actually is getting some pro-Brady Bizarro commentary, and they've actually spelled his name correctly.
Oh, geez.
With one Z and two R's, the rolling R. So kudos to you, commenters. So let's continue to talk a little bit about the money. You know, what we saw in 2016 and actually in years prior, and what I don't expect to see change in the years coming, one of the issues, of course, that we keep seeing has to do with enemies, let's say opponents of self-funding in general, particularly at the state and NAIC levels. For some of us, maybe it's a good faith on their part rationale. You know, you tend to hear that there's concern, particularly with smaller employers, that they can't financially afford to self-fund, and that by making self-fund less accessible to these employers, they're saving these employers from bankruptcy, that they're just not ready for this. But at the same time, there are those of us who think maybe there's more dubious sort of background rationale for some of this anti-self-funding efforts, things like concern with adverse selection, you know, redirecting healthy lives to self-funding away from the exchanges or the carriers that underpin it, which in the future may not be as big an issue anymore. But then also, particularly when you're talking about at the state level or NAIC, the fact that for many self-funded plans, ERISA preemption of state law, they don't have control over them. So there's a number of reasons why some entities out there may not be big fans of self-funding, and that's not necessarily going to change anytime soon. So keep that in mind. Another issue has to do with education. Education not in a good way, but a bad way. Many of the cost containment efforts that we've seen unfold over the last few years were adopted not really across the entire industry. They were few and far between. Reference-based pricing, of course, being a big one, using Medicare as a pricing parameter for payment. The problem is, as more people have adopted it and it's gotten more airtime, you know, these hospital associations, these trade shows, it becomes a topic of conversation. Next thing you know, there's actually concerted effort to push back against it. And I expect to see this continue in 2017, where they're going to come up with other arguments against these efforts. We need to be prepared for them. We're going to have to respond and potentially adjust our practices in response to these complaints.
One of the big things about education is not only for providers, but also for employers, particularly the HR departments. You know, in regards to reference-based pricing, for example, one of the big questions we get is, you know, there are still some grandfather plans out there. And the question that we'll get is, well, if you switch over to a reference-based pricing plan, do you now lose grandfathering status? Well, again, that's not really the question. The question should be understanding that grandfathering has less to do with the type of plan, more to do with whether or not the patient, the employees, have less benefits. Did you change the benefit structure of the plan, which will cause the grandfathering change? So, and again, I think it also ties into what Ron's going to talk about next, is the out-of-pocket, what that means in the reference-based pricing context, because we see a lot of people, they have great ideas when it comes to reference-based pricing, but they're not getting the best results, or they may be creating their own balance billing issues because they're making sure that that patient still has the same out-of-pocket expense as if it was an in-network typical PPO type of environment. So, Ron, you want
absolutely
to go there?
That's a great lead-in, Adam. You know, one of the things that I think we're seeing between the payment methodology when you're talking about how much you pay versus for what you are paying, and that's a huge difference. People who, you know, audit these claims and they're looking for things like fraud and abuse, right? Again, the difference between how much you pay for something versus what you pay for in the first place. Not paying for duplicate charges versus paying too much for a single charge are two separate topics. But in either instance, the net result is going to be the same, which is if I get two claims for the same thing, obviously it should only have been charged once. That's a billing error. I'm only going to pay for one of the two claims. If that hospital is not willing to back off, are they going to balance bill the patient? Let's say I get one claim, but it's an excessive charge for that service, so I pay what's reasonable rather than what's charged. Again, are they going to balance bill the patient? So whether it's responding to errors and mistakes or it's paying what we think is reasonable and fair, from our perspective, those are two completely separate issues, but from the employer and employee perspective, it's the same problem. You're paying less than expected, and people are being balance billed, and that begs the question, as the DOL and HHS and regulators are looking at the issue of out-of-pocket expenses and the maximum out-of-pocket, when a patient is balance billed, what counts towards that mask out-of-pocket and what does not? And you're going to find more and more the difference between paying and not paying for something that was billed in error versus paying or not paying an excessive charge is going to matter. And when you're nitpicking over the charges or the price, I think that there's going to be a lot less sympathy for us than if you're talking about not paying for something that should have never been charged in the first place. So expect to see more about that in 2017. Some other issues that we see. Look, we work with both the benefit plans, the administrators, the brokers, as well as stop loss. I already talked about how the NAIC and entities that are against self-funding are saying one of the biggest knocks against self-funding and one of the biggest weapons they're using against us is the argument that it's not financially viable, that small and even medium-sized employers cannot afford to self-fund. And what we can do is we look and we say a well-constructed benefit plan with a supportive and coordinated stop-loss program, not only is it viable, but it's the best financially sound decision an employer can make. But again, this requires coordination and cooperation between the parties. And what I hate seeing is when issues like excessive charges and billing errors come up, and these people, these entities that are supposed to work together, turn on each other and treat each other like the enemy. And we have to stop that. Some examples, you know, we look at things like the mailbox rule, where your contract, it indicates that payment needs to be postmarked or mailed by a certain date. Half these plans aren't even sending payment via mail anymore. If I'm issuing things electronically, does the stop-loss carrier and contract recognize that when determining the pay date? Things like clinical audits without supporting policy language. The same way a benefit plan cannot do anything unless it's supported by the plan document, the same argument can be made for stop-loss behavior. If a carrier wants to utilize some sort of a vendor or audit program, but the contract, the policy, doesn't allow them to do so, they should not be doing that. I feel like printing up T-shirts that say WWMP for some of these carriers, what would Medicare pay? It doesn't matter what Medicare would pay. It's what this plan is required to pay, and have you coordinated prior to issuing the policy regarding their plan document, regarding the contractual obligations they have. This takes me right down then to the PPOs.
Hey, Ron, before you get into the PPOs, one thing I want to make sure is clear. Folks, even though for 4 years now we've been doing these webinars, 4 years, we still see stop-loss policies that are signed by our clients that literally say, and Brady, you just got one a couple weeks ago, this week, that they have the right to interpret your plan doc and basically deny any claim that they feel like they don't want to reimburse that claim. Those types of provisions need to be known by the employers because they're causing the most headaches. This is not expensive. If you can just make sure that before your clients sign a stop-loss agreement, that that policy is reviewed. You don't have to review every policy. Let's say, for example, you got 10 policies with HM or 5 policies with Symetra or 5 policies with Sun Life. You don't need to review all 5. Review one. The policies are pretty much going to be the same. But that is still not being done in this industry, and I don't know why. It drives me nuts, but it's not the cost. That's the reason. I just think it's just not being done. It needs to be done. So
yeah, I'm glad you bring that up because the problem is also if you're not recognizing these problems, not only are you holding the carriers that are making these mistakes accountable, you're not holding them accountable, but you're also not giving any credit to the carriers who went through the effort of fixing these things. So it's both sides. It's the carrot and the stick. And when we talk about, you know, carriers that recognize the plan's situation, again, recognizing the PPO, the problem is that you've got an employer, you know, they're signing a PPO contract on the one hand, they've got their plan document on the other, the two documents don't align, and most carriers are going to say, listen, we insure the plan document, we don't insure that PPO arrangement. But at the same time, it's kind of impossible to not acknowledge the fact that the PPO is at least referenced in the plan document, so you know it exists. You really should dig into that ahead of time and try to recognize what it's going to end up causing, because yes, indeed, there are going to be situations where the employer cannot honor both their plan document and their network contract. What is the carrier going to do in those situations? The demand for additional information. I understand why many carriers need to protect themselves. Ultimately, particularly when it comes to those large claims, they're the ones who are holding the bag, so they feel the need to protect themselves contractually. I understand it. I'm an attorney. I'm all about disclaimers and fine print and trying to figure out ways to protect yourself from liability. But at the same time, some of these contracts are so open-ended, it basically says we can interpret your language however we want. If we feel like we don't have enough information, we can ask for more information. I don't even know what that means sometimes. And frankly, if you sign a contract that's open-ended like that, you know what? You're kind of going to get what you paid for, and you're going to get what you asked for. So you have to be careful prior to executing that agreement. These are things to look for in 2017, and I'll say it again in 2018.
Hey, so before we turn it over to Jen really quick, this is a little preview. I don't know if Jen knows, but this next slide is a little preview on our next month's
webinar topic. So make sure you do a good job, Jen. We want these guys to treat. Sell it, Jen. Sell it.
I already have singles. All right. So I want to talk before we get into this. Adam had mentioned a policy review, making sure that you review the policy. Unfortunately, reviewing the staff policy in and of itself is not good enough. It's not good enough to just send us your stop loss policy and say, review it for any gaps. Because unlike the hard gap or the soft gap, the new important gap to consider is the handbook gap. And there's no way to decide whether or not there's a handbook gap unless you provide us with your handbook and your plan document. So this is potentially going to be a, this will be an issue if you are an employer that offers any sort of continuation of coverage or leave of absence provisions under which you also want to continue plan benefits. I know I've said it in the past, but remember that this will be a gap if you both have leave of absences available and during the leave of absence allow the employee or the individual to continue coverage under the plan. Now, an example of a gap could be outlined here if the employee handbook allows a plan participant to continue their benefits while they're on an employer leave of absence that is not an FMLA leave of absence, but the plan document does not outline that. What to do? It could be a potential problem where the employer is in a bind where they have to pay to continue these benefits, but the plan doesn't allow for it. So how are you allowed to continue benefits if you are acting outside the terms of the plan document? That puts you in a potential issue where you're acting outside your responsibility and not in potentially breaching your fiduciary responsibilities. Right, Ron?
That's right.
Another example of this could be where you are promised variable amounts of leave, continuation of coverage, 16 weeks versus 12 weeks. The FPD says something and the handbook says something else. Those are things that need to be reviewed and identified in advance of the plan renewal, so you're not going to run into a situation where an employee expects their 16 weeks of disability leave, but the plan only outlines for 12. What about that additional 4 weeks of promised disability leave that they are not allowed to continue coverage for? That needs to be rectified and identified now before you're going to have an issue where someone is out on disability or out on otherwise leave of absence, and their coverage is supposed to be continued, an accident occurs, and these claims aren't getting paid because the plan doesn't allow for them to continue coverage. It's a potentially very expensive problem.
Guys, think about it. As these claims keep getting bigger and bigger, instead of having to negotiate a lower price, instead of fighting back in regards to what the charge amounts are, et cetera, what if somebody, a carrier, was able to say, hey, they're not covered because the claim's not even eligible, because we found a gap in the handbook. This is the new frontier that we're seeing a lot more of this, and that it made us come back, go back, and Brady actually was the head of this project, to look at our plan and make sure that every time we change the SPD, we also change the handbook. It's not easy to keep doing that. So it's important that this gap is rectified, and I can tell you that most of our clients, there's a big area of concern when it comes to this particular gap. So, great job, Jen.
So, what are we going to be watching for in addition in 2017? There are increased reporting requirements, whether you're talking 5500, other tax filings. These regulating agencies and entities, they want to know more about what's going on with the plan and with those that service the plan. The spotlight is on us. And the argument is going to be they want to make sure that everything's on the up and up, that it's financially viable. But don't forget, they put Al Capone in prison for tax evasion, right? So they can say they're bringing us in on one thing, but the truth is once they serve the warrant and they're in your house, they can look for whatever they want. So if you know that you're going to be examined more closely, you need to make sure that you have multiple layers of protection in place, everything is being done correctly, all your I's are dotted, all your T's are crossed, and let's face it, just assume you're a fiduciary. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what your disclaimer says. I don't care what you're doing or not doing. Just proceed under the assumption that for now you are a fiduciary. If that assumption is correct, what are you going to do to protect yourself? And I would argue that you need to bring in objective third party or parties to double check the work, to resume examination of the appeals, and again, ensure that everything is done correctly so that if you are audited, if someone is looking at the information, they can say, we're looking for cracks, but we can't find any.
Real quick, we get a couple questions such as who are the carriers, the stop-loss carriers denying claims? I'd have to kill you before I told you. No, but if you just send us over the policies, we can take a look at them, and that's the kind of information that we can give you over the phone
In addition, we're being asked anything being done when it comes to the ACA repeal related to provider billing regulations. There's a lot of stuff out there regarding billing regulations that's not being done currently. It's already law. It's just not being enforced. We can tell you that as a fact. So, in addition, one of the great comments brought up was the union plans. There's a big potential gap there between what their SPD says and what their collective bargaining agreement says. We've seen that many times as well. So, great point. Ron, sorry. For a couple minutes.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm glad that you're bringing up all these third parties, whether we're talking about the employer, union, because, again, there's communication between them as well. One of the areas that we actually expect to see some communication between parties that didn't always talk in the past is actually between providers and their patients. In the past, when a claim was denied or the payment was reduced by the plan, the provider would go directly to the plan and file an appeal. What I think that we're starting to see is some providers, they're savvy and they realize, I can use the patient as a middleman. I can explain to the patient, hey, did you know you have a right to an appeal? And they help them file the appeal. So expect to see many more of those administrative appeals and use of patients against us as well, where education is really the only combating weapon against that.
Great job, Ron. So, folks, that's it for today. Thank you so much. Join us for our next webinar, February 15th. And here's what it's about. The top miscues that employers make when it comes to their health plan and employee benefits, and what all of you out there can do to become heroes to make those problems and issues go away. We hope you join us next month. Until then, we will have a couple of podcasts between now and then. Stay tuned. Hey, Brady, have a great time tomorrow. Hope everything goes well for you as you get down there. On behalf of Jen, who did a great job today, Brady, Ron, and myself, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. And until next time, talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.